Thank you. This panel places the Palestinian right of return in its international context by describing and analyzing the current positions of some of the key players influencing the issue. The powerful influences that the Israeli and American states and the European Union exert on any discussion of the Palestinian right of return is perhaps most striking when compared to the weakness of the PLO position, which Dr. Said elaborated on this morning, and the complete silencing of the refugees themselves. The panelists who are discussing these issues are, to use an Arabic expression, أشهر من أن يعرف, which means more famous than to be presented. I will hence limit the presentations to two words, knowing that the full bios are included in your conference packets. Our first speaker is Dr. Ilan Pape, who will be presenting the Israeli position. Dr. Pape is the director of the International Relations Division of Haifa University and the academic director of the Institute of Peace Research at Givat Havira in Israel. Our second speaker is Dr. Noam Chomsky. He's a professor of in the Department of Linguistics and Philosophy at MIT. So he has written and lectured widely on linguistics, philosophy, intellectual history, contemporary issues, international affairs, and U.S. foreign policy. Our third speaker is Alain Gresh. He is the editor-in-chief of Le Monde Diplomatique and has a specialization in Middle East affairs. He's also the author of numerous books. Our fourth speaker is Mr. Jaber Saiman. He's an independent Palestinian researcher working in Lebanon and author of an article on the Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon. And finally, we have Robert Fisk, who's still sitting with the audience and will join us. He's the correspondent. He's the correspondent of the UK Independent, reporting from Beirut on Middle East and Balkan affairs. So Mr. Fisk will be speaking on the Arab government positions on Palestinians' refugee rights of return. Mr. Saiman will be speaking on the PLO from rights to return to Bantustan. Dr. Gresh will be speaking about the European Union's position, Dr. Chomsky about the U.S., and we'll start with Dr. Pape with Israel's role on the issue.
Thank you for the introduction. I'm very happy to be here and hopefully contribute to a new awareness of the refugee problem and to change the course of the peace process into a better and more constructive ways. The attitude of Israel to the refugee problem has to be analyzed against the Jewish behavior in Palestine during the 1948 war. The Labor Zionist movement wished to bridge the impossible gap between the ethnocentric nationalist ideology on the one hand and the wish to belong to the community of liberal and democratic Western states on the other. An impossibility that could only be achieved, so it had been presumed at the time, by cleansing the territory of the Jewish state from any substantial Palestinian presence. In the months leading to the war, Israel prepared its ethnic cleansing program, a plan that included mass expulsions, sporadic massacres, campaign of terror and intimidation, and finally confiscation of land and assets. When the war of 1948 ended, every possible step had been taken to prevent the repatriation of the refugees to Israel. The act of people returning to their homes after the winds of war subsided was regarded an elementary and basic humanitarian development by the international community, which through the United Nations General Assembly authorized it in Resolution 194. The international support for the unconditional repatriation of the Palestinian refugees in 1948 was even backed by the United States delegation to the United Nations. The Israeli government implemented a vigorous and callous policy of eradicating all that was left of the deserted Palestinian villages and neighborhoods, establishing in their place new Jewish settlements or turning them into cultivated land. This policy began in August 1948 and ended only in 1954. By that time, any demand for repatriation necessitated uprooting of Jewish settlers brought by the government to the new settlements or into the old Palestinian houses. During that time, some Israeli politicians and intellectuals put forward the idea of repatriation of about 100,000 refugees out of a million, some like Moshe Sharet doing it in response to American pressure, a pressure which did not last for long, others like the philosopher Martin Buber doing it out of a moral position. But the Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion rejected all these offers and led the anti-repatriation policy in full force. Ever since 1954 and until recently, the refugees were excluded from the Israeli collective memory and were replaced in the consciousness of Israelis as well as in the Hebrew vocabulary with derogative terms such as terrorists and saboteurs. There was no refugee problem on the agenda as far as the various Israeli governments were concerned. There was Palestinian terror which had to be dealt with by military means. In the end of the June 1967 war, Israel created a new refugee problem. However, those expelled from the West Bank were acknowledged as refugees by the Israeli government and public, since the public and the political system were divided on the issue of the occupied territories. Since a large number of Israeli Jews were willing to withdraw from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, the return of refugees of 1967 war to these territories seemed legitimate and did not involve any soul-searching on the part of the Israelis. The Palestine question for Israel and the world at large was the fate of the Palestinian territories occupied by Israel in the 1967 war. Israel quite successfully conducted a campaign of repressing the refugee problem out of the peace agenda. Ever since the first peace conference on the post-1948 Palestine reality, the Lausanne Conference of April 1949, the refugee problem was excluded from the peace talks and dissociated from the concept of the Palestine conflict. In the wake of the June 1967 war, the world at large accepted the Israeli claim that the conflict in Palestine evolves around the territories occupied by Israel in that war. Several Arab regimes cooperated with this notion when they were ready to abandon the refugee problem as an issue in their bilateral peace negotiations with Israel. The issue of the refugees was kept alive and in the consciousness of the people in the Middle East and in the world at large by the PLO activity and policies. Outside the Middle East, it was only the United Nations organization that mentioned in several of its resolutions the obligation of the international community to ensure the full and unconditional repatriation of the Palestinian refugees, a commitment made first in Resolution 194 from the 11th of December 1948. The Oslo Accord is not different. Its architects, Americans, Israelis and Palestinians, have placed the refugee issue in a subclause made almost invisible in the flood of words in the documents describing future bridges, bypasses, garrisons and cantons. The Palestinian partners to the accord contributed to this obfuscation, probably out of negligence, not bad intention, but the result is very clear and the same. The refugee problem, the heart of the Palestine conflict, a reality acknowledged by all the Palestinians wherever they are and by anyone sympathizing with the Palestinian cause, was marginalized in the Oslo documents. The structure built for implementing the accord accentuated the negotiators' disregard of and almost scornful attitude to the refugee problem. A multilateral committee meant to deal with the refugee problem was directed by the Israelis to deal only with the 1967 West Bank refugees, but not with the 1948 ones. The Oslo process, the implementation of the document, was no better. In fact, it was worse. The rules of the Oslo game defined support by the Palestinian leadership for the right of return as a violation of the game, similar to the building of a new Jewish settlement in the occupied territories. Not that new settlements were not built in violation of the accord, but this is beside the point. 5 years after the bifurcation and cantonization of the Palestinian entity and its transformation into a Pantustan, the Palestinian leadership was given the permission to express its wish to deal with the refugee problem as part of the negotiations over the permanent settlement of the Palestine question. The Israeli discourse at this point distinguishes between the introduction of the refugee problem as a negotiable issue on the agenda, a legitimate Palestinian move now, and the demand for the right of return, which is described as a Palestinian provocation and as a violation of the rule. The victory of Ehud Barak in the last Israeli general election was hailed locally and internationally as a return of the Jewish state to the peace track. A sigh of relief accompanied the defeat of Benjamin Netanyahu, and an optimistic air surrounded the resumption of peace negotiations with the Palestinians. As the international media was quick to note, the final stage in the long road begun in Oslo is near at hand. And yet, so far, we have witnessed the conclusion of another interim agreement, an improved version of the Vi Accord, the Sharm el-Sheikh Agreement, and preliminary negotiations on how to negotiate the final stages. In short, very little progress compared with the negotiations under the Netanyahu regime, announced in a highly dramatic manner and interpreted by whomever sponsors the Oslo Accord with the help of extremely sanguine discourse of peace. The balance of power between the present Israeli government and the Palestinian Authority ensured the exclusion so far of the refugee issue from the bilateral negotiations. Ever since the election of the new Barak government in Israel, the negotiations over a permanent settlement are heralded and announced, while at the same time no real discussions are taking place. Should these discussions finally begin, the agenda is already very clear. In January 2000, the Barak government presented a paper endorsed by the American negotiators, which defines the parameters of the negotiations. This is an Israeli dictate. There is no counter-Palestinian proposal. None had been prepared, none is being expected to be prepared. The negotiations will be an Israeli and American pressure on the Palestinians to accept the Israeli paper. This paper includes, among other things, an absolute and categorical rejection of the Palestinian right of return. It leaves open for discussion the number of Palestinian refugees that would be allowed to return to the territories controlled by the Palestinian Authority, that is, 1967 refugees, territories that would comprise 60% of the Gaza Strip and 55% of the West Bank. Thus, if the Israelis and the American negotiators have their way, the right of return, as it was legitimized and defined by Resolution 194 from 11 of December 1948, is excluded from the terms of the final agreement between the Palestinian Authority and the State of Israel, an agreement which is meant to end the conflict and on which a permanent peace would be declared as being intact and valid, probably on the lawn of the White House. How would the Palestinian Authority react to such a dictate? Until now, and this report is written in the beginning of April 2000, it does not have as yet to respond. There is a stalemate as the two sides fail to agree on the agenda and the timetable. The progress on the Israeli-Syrian front has also decelerated the negotiations, but they may be resumed in any given moment given the deceleration on the Israeli-Syrian front. A Palestinian insistence on bringing to the table the right of return as a topic for negotiations has already been preempted by Ehud Barak, who declared that in this case the two sides would have to be content with the signing of yet another interim agreement and leave it at that, while this should not preclude another ceremony on the White House lawn declaring the end of the Palestine conflict. The two sides would have to wait for better times before they resume the attempt to conclude a permanent settlement. Should the Palestinian Authority give in to the Israeli demand, it would deny the most formative and basic element of the Palestinian existence, equal to a Palestinian readiness to abandon the claim to Palestine itself. A considerably domestic coercion against any opposition inside the authority's territories on the one hand, and an absolute secession of the authority's ties with the rest of the Palestinian people on the other, would be the price the authority would have to pay in order to keep its leadership at least in the territories. For many Palestinians, the discourse of peace employed ever since the beginning of Oslo would produce a reality of oppression and indirect occupation, as well as a perpetuation of the refugee problem. The arsenal of violence and armed struggle on the Palestinian side has not as yet been exhausted, and in due course another uprising or guerrilla warfare could be expected, motivated by the sheer force of frustration and dismay, more powerful than ever before in Palestine's history. The peace process would produce finally another bloodshed. In order to prevent this, several campaigns should be enacted from now on. The first is within the Palestinian communities themselves, including those in Israel. in the territories and the diaspora for presenting a united front on the issue of the refugees. The second, in the world at large, and in particular in America, for the sake of explaining and depicting the possible scenarios that can develop from the post-Oslo reality. The major aim here is to remove the halo of peace hovering over the Barak government. Inquiry Commission would easily find out that the present government is acting as brutally in the territories still under its control as the Netanyahu government did. It builds settlements, expands beyond any precedent the Jewish takeover of Greater Jerusalem, abuses Palestinians and checkpoints, transferring them from East Jerusalem and cantonizing their country. The second aim is to stress the strong and undeniable connection between the continued disregard for the refugee problem and the inevitable collapse of the peace process. The third should be waged in Israel itself. It is no incident that the leading member of the Labour Party advocated, notwithstanding a strong rebuke from his Prime Minister, the return of at least 100,000 refugees to Israel proper. The number at this stage is not important. The principle is. In the center and left of center of the Jewish state, there is a recognition, not widespread admittedly, but growing, of the need to consider seriously the right of return, if not on an ethical basis, at least on a functional one. In the case of the United States, due to its paramount and decisive role in the peace process, one should try another and additional approach. The American negotiator's tendency, which does not change from one administration to the other, is to adopt a quantitative approach to the conflict solution. Anything which is measurable is visible and therefore divisible. It is high time that American negotiators will acquaint themselves with more invisible aspects of the conflict, which are indivisible. The Israeli guilt and responsibility are also an important, indeed a decisive factor in the process of reconciliation and peacemaking. Israel as a victimizer should be forced to face its past through direct contact with the victims. It should seek together with the victims, not vengeance, but what in South Africa was rightly called restorative justice. This means the payment of compensation for the victims, rectification of past evils through the right of return, and a territorial solution that would enable both Jews and Palestinians to live in peace under a political strict structure and within a geographical space representing their aspirations and hopes. In other words, the merchandise peace negotiators should sell is not just territories for peace. Far more important, or at least equally important, is restitution and retribution. In various parts of the world, such mediation between victimizers and victims are taking place. There are places where even survivors of genocides have to live and learn to exist with the descendants of the genociders. It is possible, if it is possible there, in such awful cases, it should be possible here. But for that to happen in Israel and in America, one should restore the mirror to the faces of the Israelis and force them to confront what they had done in 1948 and realize the implication of that deed for the chances of peace in the Middle East. Those who are committed to the cause of Palestine, to the cause in Palestine, Israel, and in the world at large, should move from slogans to concrete planning. A scheme should be devised on the basis of the work of Salman Abu Sitta and others, which explains how the right of return can be implemented. There were plans in the past, even by Jews such as Martin Buber in 1958, who advised abortively the government of his days to compensate the refugees and accept at least a symbolic number of refugees back to the country, which can inspire a bold and more just solutions to the problem. The scheme should take into account the new realities on the ground, as well as the needs and predicaments of the various refugee camps and their particular conditions. There is also a need to connect the solution for the refugee problem to the question of the future political structure in Israel and in Palestine. It seems that the post-Oslo reality created a strong Jewish state and a weak Palestinian protectorate. The large number of Jewish settlers in and around the protectorate, the million Palestinian citizens of Israel, and the basic economic and military balance of power may defeat the idea of a two-state solution. There is a better chance of solving the right of return in a more loose political structure between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean, one which relates to Jewish nationalism as well as to Palestinian nationalism, but more importantly, helps to rectify the horrendous crime committed against the Palestinian people in 1948 without causing more sorrow and suffering. This is not an easy task, but one without which the conflict in Palestine would be far from being solved and settled. Thank you.
Trust you will be a stern disciplinarian, since you know, I'm counting on you. In the few minutes that allotted to me, I'll concentrate on U.S. policy, and I'd like to focus on one particular event, namely the signing of the Declaration of Principles and surrounding events in September 1993. In Washington, and the way the processes have played themselves out since that time in a quite predictable fashion, and how the few words on how the situation evolved to that stage. So time to mention only a few highlights. In the early September 1993, that period, in the Declaration of Principles itself, in the Washington meetings, the refugees one issue was the Palestinian refugees. That issue didn't arise, but it did arise a few months later at the first meeting of the General Assembly that took place after the Oslo Accord signing in Washington. That's December 1993, and at that General Assembly meeting, the United States essentially settled the issue of the refugees from its point of view, and as Ilan Pape pointed out, the U.S. point of view is decisive. It has overwhelming force, and though it doesn't determine everything, it has a huge impact on what happens in that region, a near decisive impact. The U.S., the Clinton administration at the U.N., rescinded Resolution 194, in effect. It voted against it for the first time. The preceding support for it had always been hypocritical, so in a way this was a welcome move. It resolved an element of hypocrisy, but the U.S. voted against 194 for the first time, two votes against it in that session, Israel and the United States. The U.S. also, I should mention on the side, just as background, that since the 1960s, since decolonization began to have an effect on the United Nations, and it was no longer a completely pliable instrument of U.S. policy, it has fallen out of favor, and the U.S. has been essentially trying to dismantle or marginalize it. That began in the 1960s. You can see that in many ways. For example, Security Council vetoes. The United States is far in the lead, Britain second, France a distant third, contrary to standard propaganda. And it's on a whole range of issues, not just the Middle East, all sorts of other issues. Same is true of General Assembly votes. Agencies of the UN that have a kind of a third world orientation, like UNESCO and UNCTAD, have been kind of either marginalized or in some cases destroyed, organization defunded, and so on. So the vetoing of the rescinding of Resolution 194 fits in a more general pattern. At the same session of the UN, the United States called for restricting or terminating UN activity, these are quotes, with regard to Israel and Palestine, and eliminating all earlier UN resolutions as terms that were used, obsolete and anachronistic. That included all calls for Palestinian rights or all opposition to settlement in the territories. The U.S. position was, quoting, it is unproductive to debate the legality of these issues. And indeed, it was unproductive because from the U.S. point of view, the issues had been settled. The United States was now proceeding to impose a settlement that it had been committed to in almost total international isolation for over 20 years, but it was now being instituted. Rescinding Resolution 194 meant also rescinding Article 13 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The 194 was passed the day after the Universal Declaration was unanimously passed, and it was essentially a spelling out of Article 13, actually of one half of Article 13. The other half of Article 13 is the best known UN resolution, is the best known part of the Universal Declaration. That's the part of resolution of Article 13 that says everyone has a right to leave his own country. As long as the Cold War was on, every year in Boston and other places there would be passionate denunciations of the Soviet Union for refusing to let our people go and their violation of Article 13 of the Universal Declaration, led by distinguished Harvard University professor, law professors, and so on and so forth. I never once in all of those years ever saw a reference to the last few words of the same sentence. Everyone has a right to leave their own country or to return to their own country. Never once did I see those words mentioned, and it's those words that were spelled out the next day in Resolution 194. By now, the first half of the resolution is irrelevant. You don't need it as a Cold War weapon anymore, and the second part is rescinded, so Article 13 is gone, and with it we have an end to hypocrisy, which, as I say, is a good thing. The second main issue that arose at Oslo was the question of Palestinian rights, and they too were ignored. It's crucial to recall, and this is a big U.S. victory, that the Declaration of Principles, in its reference to the permanent settlement, you know, what happens down the road, referred only to UN 242, not to the other UN resolutions which call for Palestinian national rights alongside of Israel. 242, of course, is completely rejectionist. It says nothing about Palestinian rights. In fact, the word Palestinians isn't mentioned. There's a phrase about the just rights of refugees, but that's in passing. So UN 242 is a totally rejectionist resolution, nothing about Palestinians, and the fact that the permanent settlement is based on it is an important victory for the United States, established again in September 93. A third issue that arose is the right of resistance. Now, the international community has unanimously, except for the United States and Israel, agreed, and this is unanimous in this case, that people have the right of resistance to racist and colonialist regimes and foreign military occupation. That issue did arise again, it wasn't in the Declaration of Principles, but a side part, Arafat was compelled to sign yet another statement. I don't know how many there have been, but this was another one, renouncing terrorism, but also pledging to suppress any resistance. So now the new Palestinian Authority is to become an agency of the United States and Israel in suppressing the right of resistance, which is accepted at least formally, it's only formal, unanimously by the rest of the world, in this case without exception. That was then, it's been the subsequent agreements have sharpened that, the Y Accords particularly, and so on. This abrogation of the right of resistance is not against, like the UN, it's not a specific Israel-Palestine issue. It also applies elsewhere, I mean, obviously in Lebanon, where the Lebanese do not have the right of resistance to U.S.-backed Israeli attacks, but also in other countries. So, for example, right at this moment, the Turkish army is carrying out another major sweep in southeastern Turkey in regions which have been virtually devastated in the some of the worst ethnic cleansing and operations and massive atrocities of the 1990s with enormous U.S. support. They're also invading northern Iraq again, and this is to kill Kurds. And Kurds do not have the right of resistance to repression, vicious repression in this case, supported by the Clinton administration, because they're standing in the way of U.S. policies. And it extends more generally. So Nicaraguans didn't have the right of resistance to attack and so on, nor the right to defend their country, in fact. So this is general, but it was in particular in this case. The fourth issue that arose after refugees, political Palestinian rights and right of resistance all eliminated, the fourth issue that arose in the Declaration of Principles was the question of territorial settlement. Well, here the permanent settlement is supposed to be on the basis of UN 242, but it's important to bear in mind, as I'm sure you all know, that there are two versions of UN 242. There's the version that was the initial, that was actually approved and signed and in fact initiated by the United States and was the U.S. position, and that meant withdrawal to the pre-June 67 borders with minor and mutual territorial adjustments. So if some line was curved, you could straighten it out. That was the world position and the U.S. position, the interpretation of 242, until February 1971, when President Sadat of Egypt accepted the U.S. version, in fact, an even more forthcoming version, leaving the United States in an odd position. It could either join Israel in rejecting 242, or it could maintain its own position but support Egypt against Israel. And there was an internal bureaucratic battle, which was won by Henry Kissinger. It's one of his contributions to world peace. I think that's probably one of the reasons why he's now the honorary guest of the International Chaplains Association at their humanitarian awards dinner, which is taking place right about now. But Kissinger won that internal struggle. And since then, since 1971, the U.S. policy has been that UN 242 does not call for Israeli withdrawal. It calls for withdrawal as determined by the United States and Israel, so whatever that would be. And what it is some version of the Israeli alone plan of 1968, which changes a little bit over the years, but is fundamentally the same. Effectively, Israel will maintain control over the usable territories and the resources of the West Bank and Gaza, but it won't, it doesn't want to administer downtown Nablus or downtown Gaza City, which is, would be ridiculous. And these should be assigned to the Palestinian Authority to rule in the manner of other colonialist regimes. So in the manner in which Indians ran India under the British Empire, and Central American armies run Central America in the interest of the United States, or the black leadership of Transkei ran it in the interests of South Africa and so on. These are traditional patterns, and that was to be that's the territorial settlement. Again, a major victory for U.S. rejectionism. In fact, if you look over the whole thing, it's a total victory on every point. And this has been international isolation. It's worth remembering that. The U.S. unilateral interpretation of 242 has been unilateral, no notable support outside the United States. And the same is true on other issues. So in a now forgotten but quite important Security Council meeting of January 1976, there was a resolution backed by essentially the entire world, and the PLO seems to have forgotten it. But they publicly supported that resolution. And in fact, according to the Israeli UN ambassador, they actually prepared it. I don't know if that's true. The resolution called for a two-state settlement in accord with UN 242 as it's understood elsewhere in the world. So a settlement on the incorporated all the wording of 242, but added that there should be a Palestinian state in the areas from which Israel would withdraw. Israel responded to the calling of the UN session by bombing Lebanon, killing about 50 people, kind of strike against the UN, supported by the United States, so therefore legitimate. The U.S. reacted to the UN session by vetoing the resolution, then did so later. And from that point on, the U.S. has been doubly isolated. One, in rejecting UN 242 as understood by itself and the rest of the world, and two, in rejecting Palestinian national rights. Well, General Assembly has, you don't have a technical veto, but remember it is a veto if there's a vote of 150-1 and the one happens to be the United States. And that happened maybe 152 or 3 or something like that. And that happens consistently on a whole range of issues. Again, it's nothing specific to do with the Middle East, but that amounts to a veto. A veto of the resolution, and usually it's vetoing from history, so they become forgotten. And the General Assembly did vote on this year after year, votes like 150-2 roughly. The last vote was December 1990, 144-2 at that time, calling for essentially the same resolution. Particular date is important. Right after December 1990 came the Gulf War. In the Gulf War, the United States made it extremely clear to the world that the U.S. is going to run this region by force. And if anybody doesn't like it, get out of the way. I mean, whatever else one thinks about the Gulf War, that was the message. In fact, it was declared by George Bush very neatly when he announced the New World Order in 4 words. He said, "The New World Order means what we say goes. And if you don't like it, get out of the way." Well, that was understood, and that's the last UN resolution. Then comes the Madrid meetings a couple of months later, in which the U.S. instituted its unilateral rejectionist settlement. We go on to Oslo, on to the implementation of the Oslo agreements, which sort of spells it out. There shouldn't be anything particularly surprising about this. I mean, anyone who pays attention to world affairs and who's been looking at what's been happening could have foretold step by step, and many people did, everything that was going to happen. Yeah, that's the way it works. The world is ruled by force. The primary rule of international law is the rule of force. Now, of course, you appeal to the rule of law. And the way you do it, as the distinguished, respected elder statesman Dean Acheson pointed out 40 years ago, we appeal to the rule of law in order to gild our positions with moral posturing. But it's to be understood that the law does not apply to us. He happened to be addressing the American Society of International Law, and it was quite honest. That, in fact, is the way the world runs, and it's the task of intellectuals to prettify it and present it in some other fashion so that people don't see what's before their eyes. But it should be before their eyes. None of these are laws of nature, of course. They can be changed. But I think it's rather clear, at least it seems to me, that the most important changes will have to take place right here. Unless they take place within the United States, it's not going to matter much what happens elsewhere.
When I was asked to make this conference about the European Union position and the right of returns, I thought it would be an easy task. So I went to read all the resolutions of the European Union of the 80s and the 90s. And I found that the European Union certainly has taken a stand on the national right of the Palestinians, on settlement policy, on Jerusalem, even on the creation of a Palestinian state. But any reference to refugees were vague, and the term right of return was never used. I was more or less tempted to renounce to speak about it when, by chance, I stumbled on a document adopted in 1971 by the European Community and known as the Schuman document, after the name of Maurice Schuman, who was a French foreign minister at this time under President Georges Pompidou. It should be borne in mind that in those days, in the 1970s, the European Community only had 6 members: France, Germany, Italy, Netherlands, Belgium and Luxembourg. Denmark, Ireland and the United Kingdom were preparing to join the organization in 1972. This resolution, taken on the 13th of May 1971 by the foreign minister of the 6 member countries, stated a support to the Security Council Resolution 242 and demanded specifically an Israeli withdrawal to the land occupied on 4th of June 1967, with minor changes, the creation of demilitarized lands on both sides of the border of Israel, with the presence of international force not belonging to the fourth great powers, an international status for Jerusalem, and the right of return to their home for Palestinian refugees or the option of being compensated. When I spoke reading this document to some official of the European Union, nobody remembered of this resolution. And it was really very strange. And I asked myself why the European Union, which has during the 70s and the 80s taken position in support to the Palestinians stronger and stronger, including a support to the PLO as the sole representative of the Palestinian people, to the idea of the Palestinian state, why have they forgot this proposal? And I think we should understand why. To understand their silence, we must place it in its context. After the end of the Six-Day War, the Palestinian Liberation Organization and the Fedayeen movement sought to win recognition for the national right of the Palestinian people. The aim was to place the Palestinian problem in its political context and prevent it from being treated as stipulated in Resolution 242 as nothing more than a problem of refugees. At a diplomatic level, the PLO fought to obtain recognition for two principles. The Palestinians are a nation and they are entitled to self-determination, and the PLO is the sole representative of the Palestinian people. Under the circumstances, it was almost to be expected that the refugee problem should be pushed into the background, at least at this stage. If we look, for instance, to the famous Venice Declaration adopted by 9 members of the European Community in 1980, it reads, "A just solution must finally be found to the Palestinian problem, which is not simply a problem of refugees." During the whole of the 80s, the European position was just that. The Palestinian problem is not mainly a problem of refugees. The declaration went, this Venice Declaration, to state that the Palestinian people must be placed in a position to exercise fully its right to self-determination. The PLO will have to be associated with the negotiations. Although the text mentions the question of Jerusalem and the settlement, it makes no mention of the right of return or even the question of the refugees. In 1987, at the Madrid summit, at this time there were 12 members in the European community, it stated that the 12 came down in favor of upholding justice for all the people of the region, which includes recognition of the legitimate right of the Palestinian people, including the right to self-determination, with all that this implies. This was the first implicit reference to the right of the Palestinians to create a state. This support for the Palestinian national rights culminated in the Amsterdam European Council Declaration of 1997, which called on Israel to recognize, I quote, the right of the Palestinians to exercise self-determination without excluding the option of a state. This was followed by the Berlin Declaration last year, which reaffirmed the Palestinian permanent and unconditional right of self-determination, including the state option. It also stated that this right should not be subject to any veto, and Europe's readiness to consider the recognition of a Palestinian state in due course. So in about 30 years, Europe consequently came a long way toward recognizing the national right of the Palestinian people and its right to an independent state. The perception of the Palestinians underwent a profound change in Europe among the public opinion and among political leadership. From being a simple refugee problem, it became a problem of self-determination. However, we cannot avoid the fact that this was detrimental to the recognition of the principle of right of return. And I suspect that during this period, 70s and 80s, neither the PLO nor any political Arab force pushed the European Union to adopt position on this question of right of return because it didn't seem so important at this moment. At this moment, what was important, and I think for all of us what was important, was the recognition of the PLO as the sole representative of the Palestinian people and the recognition of the right of the Palestinian to a state and to self-determination. With the start of the Madrid process in October 1991 and then the Oslo Accords signed by the PLO and the Israeli government, European action entered in a new phase. On the one hand, events confirmed that in political terms, Europe had been sidelined. It played no significant role in the Madrid negotiation. It was reduced to acting as a funding agency and in the years that followed the Oslo Accord, became a major source of funds for the Palestinian Authority. We need to understand the reason for Europe's exclusion to be able to assess its chance of playing a part in a future settlement of the refugee problem. First, the European Union, and this is not restricted to the Middle East, its Middle East position, has been slow to develop as a political power. Everyone sees it as an economic giant and a political dwarf. Coordinating the policy of 15 states, now 15, as politically diverse as the United Kingdom and France, Greece and Netherlands, is not an early task, is not an easy task. Although the 1997 Treaty of Amsterdam includes provision relating to a common foreign and security policy, we are still a long way from a straightforward decision-making process. Particularly as several member countries are convinced that Europe should leave the United States in the Middle East, plenty of room for maneuver, as they are the only country capable of acting as intermediary. The second reason why Europe is not playing an important role is that the various parties involved in the negotiation, the USA, Israel, but also the Arab states and the Palestinians, do not take Europe seriously. This is easy enough to understand in the case of the American and Israeli, but the Palestinian and the Arab states, who keep saying they want Europe to play an important part, do very little to support its participation in the field. However, Europe's political role acquired new impetus during the last years. In 1996, this led to the appointment of Miguel Angel Moratinos as European Union representative for the Middle East, in addition to several political proposals to provide the various parties with guarantees and a number of original ideas. On the question of the refugee, the European Union took part in the multilateral refugee working group set up by the Madrid Conference that started in October 1991. Although there is still little to show for the negotiations which have stopped now, they have forced the European Union to face up to the problem. However, it was above all the end of the interim period in 1999 and the start of the negotiation on the final status that made everyone in Europe realize how important it was to find a solution to the Palestinian refugee problem. At the European Council meeting in Luxembourg in 1997, the European Union expressed its, I quote, readiness to contribute to permanent status negotiation by offering specific suggestions to the parties on related subjects, including possible Palestinian statehood, border security, arrangement, settlement, refugees, Jerusalem, and water issues. In April 1998, and I think it's important, the European Union took a decision to create an informal working group on refugees, setting the following objectives: to identify and develop topics on which information and thinking is inadequate, to foster contacts with and between the parties, to develop elements of reflection that would help the European Union to direct its policy in favor of a solution to the refugee problem. On the 6th of October 1998, the group approved a French proposal to prepare an internal memorandum on the guiding principle for a common European position on the refugees question. The group recommended that the term of this document should not be, quote, too prescriptive, emphasizing that the solution could not be restricted to a bilateral issue and that it had to have a regional and international dimension that justified the attempt to define a common European position, European Union position on the question. However, in the course of the consultation, no reference was apparently made to accept the Resolution 194 as a basis of discussion, even if individually all the European countries are voting every year in the United Nations in favor of this resolution. I want, in conclusion, to say something about the French position, which is one of the few countries to continue to refer explicitly to the right of return. Addressing the Senate Commission on Foreign Affairs on the 24th of November 1999, Hubert Védrine, the French Minister of Foreign Affairs, said, "Israel is clearly against the return of the first wave of Palestinian refugees and is moving towards the idea of compensation. As far as France is concerned, the basis in international law regarding this question is to be found in the various United Nations resolutions which affirm the right of return of the refugee. Ultimately, it is up to the interested party to find a solution." In other words, he clearly reaffirmed the refugee right of return. This right was also reaffirmed by him during a visit in Beirut in November 1999. He said to the Beirut radio station, "The Palestinian refugee in the Lebanon must be treated fairly and in keeping with international law. Resolution 194 speaks for the right of return. It is a principle to start from, and we must try to move forward through negotiation and discussion." During his trip also, he suggested that in due course, une concertation internationale, meaning an international dialogue, should be initiated on Palestinian refugees. This should be based on the following principle. The problem of refugees and displaced persons is an important issue. It does not only concern Israel and the Palestinian Authority, but also the so-called host parties. This proposal is still vague, but it could, if it was taken up by the various partners, in particular by the Palestinian and Arab countries, gather substance, enabling the refugee problem to be formulated in a more positive fashion. In conclusion, I just want to say that European Union can play an important role in the Middle East. It will depend on many factors, among them, of course, the development of a public opinion in support of the Palestinian people inside the different European countries, but it will also depend on the willingness of the Palestinian and the Arab country to develop an alliance with the European Union. Thank you very much.
That was part one from the Right of Return Conference held at Boston University Law School. Make sure that you tune in next week for the second part of this panel.